Okay, so let's start with a name that is going to immediately conjure up a very specific image for you. If I say Jim Kirk, where does your brain go?
I mean, it goes straight to the bridge of the Enterprise, right? Gold uniform, fighting a Gorn, maybe hitting on an alien.
Yeah,
It's unavoidable.
exactly. And honestly, the subject of today's deep dive does not shy away from that association at all. I mean, his blog is literally called Captain's Log.
Yeah, he leans right into it.
He does. But we do need to make a really important clarification right up front. We are not talking about the fictional Starfleet officer today.
No, although the journey we are looking at is it's its own kind of odyssey, really. We're doing a deep dive into the 25-year career and the surprisingly detailed digital archive of a real-life technology executive from Nova Scotia.
Right. And what I love about the source material is that it isn't just a biography. You know, we aren't just reading a dry resume here. We have a massive stack of
It's a
sources.
gold mine.
It really is. We've got a blog, jimkirk.org, that dates all the way back to the early 2000s, plus a professional portfolio and a really detailed career history that brings us right up to the present day in 2026.
It's essentially a longitudinal study of the modern IT worker. We are tracking a human being who goes from being a hands-on keyboard geek, and those are his words, not mine.
I love that phrase.
Right. From the dot-com era all the way to a high-level executive managing AI and zero-trust networks today.
And that is really the mission for our deep dive today. We want to understand that evolution because how do you go from fixing servers in a basement to strategizing client architecture for a massive organization?
And more importantly, how do you document that life while it's actually happening?
Exactly. That intersection of professional growth and personal history is the big theme here because he's been blogging since the days when people actually kept personal blogs, you know, before social media just completely took over
Yeah,
everything.
he's chronicling everything from server crashes to his massive obsession with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
So let's unpack the origin story a bit. Because before he was an AVP at a major corporation, he was just a guy in rural Nova Scotia trying to figure his life out. And looking at the early timeline, it was not a straight shot into technology.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of you listening will actually relate to this. He starts at St. Francis Xavier University in the mid-90s, and he's on that, respectable path, business degree, with plans to go into law at Dalhousie.
The classic parents will be proud career track.
Exactly. But it just doesn't stick. He realizes that path isn't for him at all, and he drops out.
Wow.
Yeah. And by 1999, he makes a hard pivot. He enrolls in a computer training institute to get a computer network technician diploma. He basically decides to follow the passion rather than the script.
Which is a huge risk, but that decision leads to the first real trek of his career. He leaves the East Coast and heads all the way to Ontario for a government job. And looking at his resume, he really started down in the trenches.
Deep in the trenches, we're talking year 2000, 2001, he lands a job as a technical support analyst for the Ontario Ministry of Public Safety and Security, and then he moves into a role called incident coordinator.
Okay, I want to pause on that title for a second, incident coordinator. To the uninitiated, that just sounds like corporate speak. But in the context of IT in the early 2000s, what does that actually mean?
It sounds super bureaucratic, but it is actually high adrenaline crisis management. Think of it as being a 911 operator, but for the government's digital nervous system.
Right.
When a network goes down or email stops working or a server literally catches fire, the incident coordinator is the person standing right in the middle of the chaos, trying to get the right people to fix it before the government just grinds to a halt.
So it's definitely not a quiet desk job where you just hide in a cubicle all day. You are the focal point of the panic.
Precisely. You are triaging disaster. And that experience is crucial because by 2004, he moves into IT security. And again, context is everything here. 2004 was the era of the giant worm outbreaks.
Oh man, I remember this. Blaster, Sasser, Code Red.
It was the Wild West. If you were in security back then, you weren't writing policy documents or attending nice conferences. You were fighting active infections that were taking down thousands of computers at a time.
Yeah, it was real combat.
It was forensic investigation, it was rapid containment, it was war.
And this actually leads us to a specific blog post that really caught my eye. It's titled Getting Tricked Into Management.
Such a great title.
It is, because he admits he viewed himself as this introverted geek. He never actually wanted to be the boss. So how does that transition even happen?
Well, it's the classic trap for highly competent technical people. Think about the skills we just talked about. Incident coordination requires keeping a cool head in a crisis. Security requires systems thinking, like really understanding how everything connects.
Right.
If you are good at those two things, leadership inevitably looks at you and says, that person should be in charge.
Even if the person just wants to hide and configure routers all day?
Exactly.
Yeah.
He describes it as being tricked, but really it was inevitable. By 2006, he selected to build and manage a service desk in St. Catharines. And suddenly, the introvert who just likes computers is managing 50 human beings.
Which is a massive jump. And he wasn't just managing a small team either. He eventually scaled up to a huge level within the Ontario Public Service.
The scale is staggering. By the time he leaves Ontario, he had been a senior manager for the OPS IT service desk, supporting 68,000 government employees.
That is the size of a small city.
Yeah. At one point, he was managing the service order management office.
Now, service order management, that sounds incredibly dry. Why is that piece so significant?
It sounds dry, but it's the logistical backbone of the entire province. They were processing 10,000 orders a month. Every time a new employee started, needed a laptop, needed access to a database, or just moved desks, that's a service order.
Right, so if that process breaks down.
If that machine jams, the government freezes. Managing that flow is like being the chief mechanic for a giant engine that never ever stops running.
So he masters the bureaucracy. He's running this massive machine in Ontario. But then the narrative shifts again. The call of the East brings him back home.
This is the return to the king moment, to mix our fantasy metaphors a bit. He moves back to Nova Scotia, but now he's not the entry-level tech support guy anymore. He joins the Halifax Regional Municipality, the city government, and the work becomes much more tangible.
Yeah, I saw the public Wi-Fi executive brief in his portfolio. That's the kind of thing that regular people walking down the street actually notice.
Exactly. When you work for a city, IT stops being back office and starts being infrastructure. He led the planning for public Wi-Fi using the municipality's own fiber network. But the project that really stood out to me was the transit technology roadmap.
This was a $50 million project, right? That's not small change at all.
No, it's a major capital investment.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about throwing computers on buses. It was about totally modernizing the rider experience.
Like stopping fare evasion.
Right, fare evasion. Enabling real-time tracking so you actually know when the bus is coming. This is where IT directly impacts the quality of life for citizens every day.
It's so interesting to see that shift from keeping the lights on to literally building the city. And then he pivots again. This time he goes to higher education at the Nova Scotia Community College, or NSCC.
This is a really significant chapter. He serves as the Director of Digital Innovation there from 2016 to 2021. And if you look at the portfolio, this is where the modern cloud era really hits his timeline. He led the migration to Microsoft 365.
Now, I do have to play devil's advocate here for a second. Sitting here in 2026 saying we moved to Microsoft 365 sounds like basic table stakes. Why was this such a big deal for him?
You really have to understand the environment. Higher education is notoriously resistant to change. You have faculty, administration, students, all with totally different needs and a huge amount of institutional inertia.
They like things the way they are.
Exactly. So moving an entire college from old school on-premise email servers to a fully cloud-based collaborative environment is a cultural revolution. If you mess that up, the college revolts.
He also mentions a cloud ERP strategy in his notes. For anyone listening who might not be deep in the corporate IT world, what exactly is an ERP?
ERP stands for Enterprise Resource Planning. It is the massive software brain that runs literally everything. Student grades, payroll, HR, finance. It is the central nervous system of the organization.
And he wanted to move that massive brain to the cloud too.
You wanted to strategize it, yeah. His notes talk about diversifying risk and moving away from reliance on single providers. This is high-level strategic governance. He wasn't just buying software anymore. He was looking at the contracts and asking, what happens if this vendor fails? Do we actually own our data? That is CIO-level thinking.
So we've seen him in government, we've seen him in city infrastructure, we've seen him in a college. Then in 2021, another big shift, he goes into consulting with the Infotech Research Group.
This is the teacher phase.
Hmm.
He shifts from doing the work to advising the people who do the work. He becomes an executive counselor.
And looking at the research he published during this time, the topics feel really different. He's not writing about routers and servers anymore. He's writing about burnout, change leadership, cost optimization.
That burnout piece is so telling. Because after 20 years of incident response, virus outbreaks, and managing 68,000 users, he's realized that the hardest problems in IT aren't technical at all. They're human.
Yeah.
He's creating content to help other leaders survive the exact job he used to do.
That is such a great insight. But he clearly couldn't stay on the sidelines forever, because by 2025, he's back in the driver's seat at Maximus Canada as an AVP. And this is where we see the real cutting edge stuff. His resume lists zero trust security principles and AI.
Let's unpack zero trust, because it's a term that gets thrown around a lot in corporate buzzword bingo. In the old days, like when you started back in 2000, security was like a castle. You had a firewall, which was the moat.
Yeah.
And if you were inside the castle, the network just trusted you.
But today, the bad guys are often already inside the castle, or they stole the keys.
Exactly. Zero trust assumes the breach has already happened. It means trust no one, verify everything, every device, every single login, every time. It's a massive architectural shift for any company.
And regarding AI, he notes it as a productivity enhancer and a tool for customer journey innovation, which is a very practical approach.
Right. He's not just using AI to write polite emails. He's looking at how to use it to make the business run smoother. And practically speaking, he's rolling out Microsoft Surface devices and in tune with a 99% success rate. So even now as an AVP, he still cares deeply about the end user experience, making sure people actually have good devices to work on.
Speaking of devices,
oh boy,
let's talk about the blog. Yeah. Because while he's doing all this high-level strategy, Captain's Log reveals a man who has some very strong opinions about hardware.
The hardware wars. There is a seminal post from 2021 called The Fall of the Laptop.
He was not happy about laptops, was he?
Not at all. He contrasts the modern devices with the chunky bricks of the early 2000s. And usually you expect tech guys to just love the new, sleek stuff. But he argues that laptops peaked around 2017.
Wow, 2017.
Yeah, he felt that new ones had worse keyboards. They took away all the ports. He was really disillusioned with the industry trend.
He specifically calls out the Dell Latitude 5285 as the beginning of the end. But he isn't a total hater of new tech. There's a post from 2010 called the iPad Effect, where he is just buzzing with excitement.
That's the roller coaster of being a true tech enthusiast. When the iPad came out, he recognized immediately that tablets were going to fundamentally change how we consume media. So he appreciates innovation, but only when it actually works. He does not like change just for the sake of thinness.
Which brings us to a topic I think a lot of you listening will heavily relate to, the home lab. This became a major theme during the pandemic in 2020.
The network stress of 2020. It was such a universal experience. He writes about how the whole family was working from home or learning from home, and the standard consumer-grade router just couldn't take the load.
Teams calls were dropping, connections were lagging, kids are screaming.
Exactly.
But unlike most of us who just unplugged the router, waited 10 seconds, and plugged it back in, he went full engineer mode.
He admits it spiraled. He started building a highly complex home lab. And for those who don't know, a home lab is basically a mini data center you build in your own house. You buy old enterprise servers, you run your own cloud storage, your own media servers.
He talks about self-hosting compute options, so he's essentially acting as the CIO of his own living room.
It's how you stay sharp. He was nerding out on server infrastructure at home just to keep his troubleshooting skills fresh. It shows that underneath the fancy executive title, he never really lost that hands-on keyboard desire.
And that massive infrastructure also supports the gaming habit. I loved the post about virtualized household gaming.
This is a serious, serious setup. But he makes a very important cultural distinction first. They are a PC gaming family, not a console family.
Shots fired at the PlayStation crowd right there.
Absolutely. He lists 5 gaming rigs in the house, one for him at his desk, computers in the kids' rooms, plus 2 home theater PCs. Hooked up to the TVs. They're playing Overcooked, Rayman, Minecraft, Roblox. It paints this really great picture of a household that bonds through technology rather than being isolated by it.
It really does. And that naturally brings us to the personal side of the log, because amidst all the tech talk and the server configurations, there's this very sweet, decades-long love story woven through all these posts.
It's the story of the American girl, Alicia. They met online, which, remember, in the early 2000s was still a bit novel. Some parents considered it pretty risky. And the blog chronicles the sheer effort of keeping that relationship going.
The driving. He mentions putting 25,000 kilometers on a Honda Accord, just driving back and forth between Ontario and Pennsylvania. That is dedication.
And he frames their life through what he calls the Kirk luck.
Mm.
Apparently, the family believes that if they didn't have bad luck, they'd have no luck at all.
Right.
He documents car accidents, health issues. It definitely wasn't always smooth sailing for them.
But there's a lot of humor there, too. I cracked up reading the story about the 80s costume party.
I'm dating Cindy Lauper.
Yes. He sees his wife in her costume across the room and has this sudden, hilarious moment of realization. It's just a funny human little anecdote that really grounds the whole story.
And we absolutely cannot analyze Jim Kirk without analyzing the doggos.
Miniature dachshunds, a very specific choice of breed.
Oliver, Sophie, Daisy, Debo. They're recurring characters in the log. But even with the dogs, his engineering brain just takes over. There's a post called Elevating Your Doggos.
Let me guess, he didn't like the standard store-bought dog rams.
Not at all. He says they're poorly made and basically unsafe.
Yeah.
So he treats it like a city infrastructure project. He designs and builds custom ramps so the dogs can access the furniture without hurting their long backs. It's that exact same problem-solving mindset he uses for government networks, just applied to wiener dogs.
That is fantastic. And honestly, the blog is full of these mundane but weirdly fascinating rants. Like, he gave up Pepsi in 2004 because of abdominal pain.
And we cannot forget the Raisin Bran rant of 2003.
Oh, please, let's talk about the Raisin Bran.
This is peak early blogging era content. He was eating Raisin Bran and felt that the Two Scoops marketing claim was an absolute lie. So what does the future IT executive do?
He audits the cereal.
He counts them. He pours a bowl and does the math and decides Kellogg's was just screwing the consumer.
That is so petty, but so completely relatable.
It is. And of course, there's the Steelers obsession, the whole Big Ben Roethlisberger era. He writes about the draft, the Super Bowl runs. He writes about dealing with a torn calf muscle while trying to figure out ergonomics in a work-from-home world during the pandemic. It's a reminder that even high-level executives are just regular people screaming at the TV on Sundays.
So when we step back and look at this entire stack, the resume, the professional portfolio, the 25 years of blog posts, what are we really looking at here?
We are looking at a true chronicler of the digital age. Jim Kirk didn't just work in tech, he lived it, and he documented it in real time. He captured the shift from the dial-up era, where you had to drive a Honda Accord across the border to see your girlfriend, to the Zoom era, where you can run a global AI initiative from your home office.
It's amazing to see the thread of the reluctant leader running through all of it, too.
It really is. The portfolio items like burnout and governance, they show a leader who cares deeply about the human side of the technology. And I think that comes directly from his early days in support. He knows exactly what it's like to be the guy answering the phone when the entire system crashes. He never lost that empathy.
And he kept the receipts. He actually mentions using the Wayback Machine to recover lost parts of his blog. He valued his own history enough to go dig it up and save it.
And that raises a really important provocative thought for anyone listening today. In an era where we constantly delete our posts and refresh our feeds and just move on, Jim Kirk kept the log for over two decades.
It makes you think about your own footprint.
It does. Think about your own career. Are you building a portfolio of your specific wins? Are you keeping a log of the lessons you've learned? Or are you just letting the years blur together into one long Teams meeting? Because as Jim Kirk shows us, the journey from a college dropout to an AVP is made up of a thousand little stories. Raisin counts, dog ramps, server crashes, and they're all worth remembering.
That is a perfect place to leave it. A huge thank you to the Digital Archive of Jim Kirk for giving us so much to talk about today.
I live long and prosper.
I knew you were going to do it. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us, everyone.